No, imagine in your mind a timer, a 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. There's like a red light, then it's a green light, then the very sawing metal reeking, reaching, retching noise begins. Hello, I'm Michelle Perez. I'm joined with my buddy Jake, and we are, well, we're the podcast working on, as you all know. We're just hanging out today with Gretchen Felker Martin.
Hey, Michelle.
Hey, and before we kind of get into it, as always, the good old long-winded intro. Today was kind of a bummer, Jake. I got a text. I got a text today earlier on. So I figured out that for those uninitiated, I'm not really on Twitter with a main anymore. I am coming back. You'll know it when you see it, 'cause
Been discussed on the podcast before. It's a bit of a
it's been
tease.
discussed on a podcast before, and Eliza is giving me shit, but now I have no option but to, because the world is a bad and terrible place, and I have the impulse to only make it worse. So that's what we're doing. But basically, I'd gotten a text from my father, and he had no malice doing this or whatever, but basically, the family opted for, in lieu of a funeral, like just doing a small in-person service where they would like show the remains of my uncle, and then boom, cremation. Like, very unromantic. But if they did a funeral, Jake, so in a few days, what would be happening is the anniversary of I guess the aunt-in-law and my uncle Chris would be on Halloween. And so if you look at the median average for funerals immediately after someone dying, it would probably fall on their anniversary. So they opted against it, which is probably for the best, but it's a fucking bummer. My uncle Chris, I don't really speak about my family at length because the internet is full of like craven ISIS-style weirdos. I maybe talk about my dad a bit, but my uncle was very formative in my upbringing. He and it was a Catholic upbringing, so if I come off like a fucking weirdo, Midwestern Catholic. The main thrust of it is that like he introduced me to comics, and one of my proudest moments in recent memory was like giving him my printed copy of a comic, even though the subject matter, in so many words, it felt like a fucking weird thing to give your uncle, but I was happy
That
that,
is
like,
fair to say.
yeah, but it's like a feather in the cap. Like, hey, I did something. How about that? I miss him. I wish all the best to his wife, Dawn, and all the people he leaves behind. And he's left an indelible mark on myself and my brothers. He's not only our uncle, but our godfather. And that is the extent to which I want to talk about that at length. But that said, since we're on the subject of death, again, just to bring it full circle, we are here with Gretchen Felker Martin, a luminary in the fields of I don't want to say goth type shit, but someone who's had a lot of interesting things to say about revulsion, death, the erotic, the idea of on a sort of base level, all levels of art kind of being about titillation, even disgust as a form of titillation, very specific in her ways of articulating it. You could see a lot of her work in Nylon, Fan Bite. She's done wrap ups for television programs like Game of Thrones and the like. Recently, she's put out some pretty interesting takes on the film Dune. A lot of people have had quite a bit of hay they've made about a particular self-published piece she did through Patreon called I Don't Want to Grow Up and Neither Can You. And one of my favorite articles that I don't want to like 100% say it's like a big formative part about the pod, but I wish there was a world for us on the choice to consume small art was an article she did featuring Kat Graffam and a plethora of queer artists she published via Nylon. Without any further ado, I want to welcome Gretchen Felker-Martin to the show. How you doing? Oh, you also, sorry, shit. You are also through Tor Nightfire putting out the new novel, Manhunt, which I've been reading through. Gretchen Felker-Martin, everybody.
Thank you so much for saying all that nice stuff about me, Michelle. And I'm really sorry for your loss.
Yeah, no worries. All right. I want to read the room because I mentioned this before about death, but I think it was very sad, and I did like immediately cry because he's like 46, but with some people that die in family where they're like old, like nothing registers. Like I had an 80-year-old grandpa that died recently. I was like, that fucking sucks, but like nothing. Dog dies, I'm inconsolable for days. I don't know what part of the brain that is, but it's ridiculous. But no, it was like crying that day, and like, no, everyone's like catatonic. I think everyone's a nerd to death in some weird way lately. For whatever reason.
Yeah, for whatever who could say?
Yeah, who knows what's going on with that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, now that we've lived in the middle of this hailstorm of corpses for 2 years.
Yeah.
Oh man, yeah. No, we're gonna like.
I mean, I had like a visit recently from out of town, mm-hmm. and it really did like. It was nice to see them, but in going out and about the town, it was a big bummer to really realize that like everyone I talk to about the way I'm living my life in the pandemic thinks that I'm overdoing it, quote unquote. Now it's just like, mm-hmm. oh, that's part of why America hasn't figured this out yet.
I mean, you know, that we don't.
Yeah, it's just like, nah, people shrug.
I mean, it's a cumulative effect. I wouldn't want to weigh too much in on this, but I think it's also just sort of a bargaining down of the concept to a certain point where it's like, okay, so we're over past the 500,000 mark, and with comorbidities and stuff and knock-on effect stuff, it's probably like maybe in the ballpark of 1,000,001. No one really wants to talk about that. Right. And then there's also just like people that fucking live in a fantasy role-playing scenario where like no one's actually dying from this. And no, I didn't mean ivermectin. I meant avervectin. I've read every fucking pedant. I'm going to lash myself to this sinking ship. That aside, disease and pandemics and destruction, kind of a pivotal part of your upcoming book, Manhunt. I don't know how much of the book's contents are you okay with talking about without us being spoilery?
I'm totally fine with talking about it. And it does take place in a world that has been devastated by a pandemic, which is an idea I had before it happened in real life.
Yeah,
I was just about to ask that. Yeah, that's
yeah.
I'm sure that was fun to watch.
Yeah,
that was,
yeah.
It was very surreal when I. I think it was a couple of weeks after Tor decided to buy the book.
Yeah. Wow.
That like, would that be like when the news started like getting really big about it?
Yeah, that's when lockdown went into effect in Massachusetts.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, wow. And I don't know. I was going to say, so you're well past the drafting process when that comes about.
Right.
Okay. So yeah, no, I'd had something similar where I was basically pushing the follow up for my comic. And like, it's like, what if the 5G stuff was real, was the initial pitch to someone. And then now it's like, it's all much worse. I was like in Baltimore at the time. Right. And feels great, man, essentially. I've been reading through it. Jake hadn't had a chance to like look at it, but basically right now I'm kind of in the part where the mechanics of the world are kind of being elucidated upon, and we're kind of learning about our cast of characters, and also how distinctly if I'm reading this correctly, and I'm not far enough along to say anything definitively, but as far as I know, basically, if there is anyone that's like cis in this world straight up, that's like a cis man, or someone that is gender non-conforming, that isn't taking some sort of hormone blocker, if they're like, oh fuck, this has been a long time since I've whipped this one out, AMAB, or assigned male at birth, or you know, whatever medical designation you feel fits that. I'm talking myself into circles, but basically, if you aren't on hormone blockers and testosterone is at a high enough point is in your body, you're going to become a very unfriendly fellow of some sort.
And this happens not just to people whose bodies naturally produce testosterone because they're assigned birth, they're assigned gender as male, but it happens to people with polycystic ovarian syndrome. It happens to peri and postmenopausal women, sometimes to pregnant women who can experience sudden surges of testosterone. It's something that affects almost everyone in the world in one way or another.
Ooh, damn.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if I were in that world, I would simply not have testosterone.
I mean, that's the whole point of the book.
So easy.
I would simply take an excessive amount of Spiro and like really watch my potassium levels. In terms of process, a lot of people, if they don't like know this book straight up, their first introduction to you will probably be through a lot of your prolific essay work. You've done a lot of critical essays, not just disseminating the works themselves, but also fandom interaction with the work. This is sort of like a new form of cultural criticism, I think, is kind of really a post-aughts thing for the last 15 or 20 years that I think we're starting to really get our heads around. Like you could kind of see it in New York with Pagilia and a lot of those fucking freaks and weirdos from that circuit of writing. But now it's a much more sort of mainstreamed thing, and you kind of made your bones in the prestige era of television with a lot of that stuff. Where do you see a lot of this going? Like a lot of this cultural engagement and possible over engagement that the people have in the current now, you know?
Well, that's a really big question, but if I had to boil it down,
mm-hmm.
I would say that the cascading sort of illiteracy towards parsing art and events and things as simple as conversations and interactions will continue as it has been, getting worse. you know, there's a tendency once a cycle of fascist thought begins for it to go until it burns itself out, because fascism is so difficult to effectively combat in any kind of rhetorical or polite way, because it's incoherent. It has no center. Fascism is the position that whatever feeling you're having is the center of the universe. Which is part of why I write about disgust so much, because disgust is sort of the unexamined lever behind so much of what we do to ourselves and to each other. And I think that asking yourself, why do I feel disgusted right now, is a tremendously valuable thing for any person. As for this sort of trend of meta criticism about criticism, I think that over time, the chaff will sift itself out and we'll see what is usable from what remains.
Yeah, that's an interesting take. I kind of think about this because so many of the people with sort of insightful things to say, where it's like a really mixed bag, like I read a lot of people that do really interesting games writing, but like you shift that to cultural criticism or say like something in the political sphere and they're completely illiterate in it, and they speak in big overtures, they speak in broad brushstrokes. I myself am like a psychopath. I read everything, and I mean like everything. So I want to know what the trads think. I want to know what I want to know what the anime avatar, like Nazis that are like constantly bargaining down. No. This character is actually like 18 plus or what? I got to know what every blood drinking psycho thinks. To almost my own detriment, but I like a fuller understanding of the world. It's not like a patting myself on the back thing. It's just like you have like less of a sense of surprise and like no, this is the outcome of that pathology. This is a world focused more on like outcomes as opposed to like speaking in vagaries is kind of what I'd like to see, because otherwise we kind of have an intelligentsia where they talk in these broad brushstrokes, these sort of TED talk style tones, and you talk in the language of I'm just asking questions. No, you're putting out a bunch of rhetorical posts, and what other outcome are we supposed to see other than what you've laid out? Right. Which, I mean, Christ Almighty, do you remember the Dark Enlightenment at all?
Yes.
Oh. Wait, isn't that a Jordan Peterson thing or something? Am I mixing?
Oh boy. Oh, boy. Gretchen, how much of this do you know about?
I mean, I'm surface level acquainted with it, at which point I decided to stop learning about it because it was ridiculous.
Basically, and I'm probably fucking this up, Jake, but it's like a sort of Nietzschean school of thought where basically it's very, very self-motivated and very, very much like the outcome of a sort of objectivist and Randian thinking to its logical outcome, which is more about success of a elite that like tells people what they don't want to hear, et cetera. And basically it's almost as if you kind of look at how prevailing thought online works and like how winners and losers are picked now, it's going to be a bunch of venture capital guys sort of rewarding people that kind of really tamp down and make that language neutral, and so you kind of have a bunch of people that sell nootropics or self-help books be elevated to the level of, like, let's say, scholarly philosopher types, like at the public forum.
I see what you mean. Yeah.
I'm so, like, yeah, you're
the Wikipedia right now.
Oh boy. Hope you're right. I thought Mold Bug was dead. Plenty Mold of, Bug is not of dead.
Cool links on this Wikipedia page, like neo-fascist.
You know, what really kills me about these people is that Endarkenment was right there.
Oh,
yeah, it's right
absolutely.
There.
Absolutely, they can't even be good at that shit. Come on.
No,
it oftentimes centers specifically on aesthetic. A lot of these guys, like Francoists,
right?
Just
it makes me just think of the Dark Universe.
I wish, baby.
Oh yeah, with the Mummy.
The Mummy's cool though. Like, got bandages. Like, no one.
The failed Dark Universe is the first thing I think of when I hear Dark Enlightenment. I don't know.
Yeah. Honestly, yeah. But yeah, that sort of strain of thought is very pervasive now, in a way that people do have to, like, reckon with it. I don't, like, a lot of hay has been made, like Zizek's answer to a lot of this stuff was like, you know, you cannot call this fascism. He's not a fascist, you know, with regard to Trump. But I don't know, a lot of it also just sort of seems like pedantry, unequipped to deal with the ground shifting under your feet. And so Zizek's default mode is like, you know, we are all heading down a tunnel towards a train that's going to collide with us and kill us all. Which, I mean, is great imagery. I love it. But it's also just like, it's a type of strain of leftist thinking where it's like, you're so ready to accede defeat and, like, never think of things in terms of destructive, like, capacity you have that you could leverage in a positive way. But I'm just rambling at that point. In terms of some of your article writing work, Jake, you kind of wanted to hit some stuff with the old tennis racket, homie. What you gonna say, dog?
Well, I was telling Michelle before the show is that one of the ways in which I started following you on Twitter in the first place and stuff was Soprano tweets, which I absolutely credit you with the beginning to watch The Sopranos in, like, late 2019 through 2020, falling in love with it. This is a total aside, but, like, I feel like you're one of the only people I've seen who, like, whenever I tell people I love Livia Soprano, they look at me like I'm a psychopath. And I'm like, no, there's so much there. Like, wonderful in so many terrible ways.
Yeah, one of the great performances in a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And just, like, you know, very strange for me to read about it being inspired by David Chase, because it, not without getting too deep into the weeds, like, The Sopranos rang a lot of bells for me in my own personal life with regards to that exact relationship. So I had a lot to see in Livia as a character, and I feel like you're, like, one of the only people I've seen treat that character with, like, absolute respect that they deserve, for sure.
I mean, that's really important to me when I'm engaging with art. I don't think there's anything to be gained by making moral judgments about art that you're watching, but there's a great deal to be gained through empathy and analysis.
Totally. I've, like, walked people through how, like, yeah, it's not fun to have a gunshot above your head. Maybe that would make you a sour person. I don't know, like.
Yeah, you know, have you seen many Saints of Newark yet?
Yes, I was gonna ask, because we watched it. I think, were you there, Michelle? Did we watch it together?
We didn't watch it together, but we had words about many Saints, basically.
Out of everyone that I think watched it in the group that me and Michelle kind of all keep in touch with, I was the one that probably like was the most generous. I liked it the most. I did not dislike the Many Saints of Newark.
I was also into it.
Yeah.
And I thought that bringing that moment in, which could have been, you know, such a cheap callback and in a lesser writer's hands, and then suddenly it snaps that famous exchange between Tony and Janice into a new perspective, which is that Tony is the family member with enough insight to understand that it's a horrific story, not a funny one.
Right. Yes. Just the fact that they gave that scene the gravity that they did, like, I really enjoyed the crap out of that scene.
Me too.
Just from that perspective.
I'm an apostate thinker here in that I've done. There were so many strange callbacks, and the tone shifted very wildly that I kind of felt like I was in the midst of a pitch for the first season of a new HBO Max show, which apparently they've been in talks about and are considering, like, doing this specific era onward as sort of a prequel show, which kind of makes it make a bit more sense, because as a self-contained story, I actually love the tendency of David Chase to kind of have his characters and the events and stuff, like, get left on the table and not necessarily get, like, followed up on immediately, because there's not a lot of definitive closure in life. And, like, the show is so much about it is about family and regret and, like, the sort of downward arc, like, in microcosm, not just of America, but, like, just decline generally. That's a major theme throughout The Sopranos is decline, degeneration, and
the era is over.
Yeah, yeah.
It's starting to crumble.
And, like, how do friendships, family be retained when, you know, so much of it is disposable? And there's so much fan service in the film, and there were so many strange decisions that, like, I didn't like it as much as I don't love the movie. Do I enjoy it? Sure. But, you know, teach their own. That said,
that, Jake, I interrupted you. You were in the middle of saying something about Livia.
Oh, no, just that, you know, I think you just brought it up because I had called to mind that scene, and that it was like, I feel like it's so hard for some people to really empathize with Livia when actually, like, you know, on some level, like, Tony, the main character of the show, is, like, one of the only people that can do it. That's just, like, super weird to me, because I've had, I've had a mom who I loved but was not easy to talk to and was maybe not the nicest person. And everyone who's had to deal with that, I think, knows that, like, it's just fucking complicated. And I've never seen it put on TV so effectively, like, delivered as I had. I was, like, just thinking back to the idea that I was literally a child. No, I was, like, a child and a teen going through some, like, you know, dumb bullshit. And then watching it as an adult on The Sopranos, watching Tony's relationship with his mother as an adult, just being like, it shook me a little bit. I was just like, oh, crap, this is actually what it was like. Like, this is, like, ringing a lot of bells in my head right now. It's pretty nuts. And then just understanding also, like, the humanity of the show, the humor in it, like, yeah, it was nice to actually watch something that I had absolutely missed out on through the lens that, you know, ultimately I was introduced to by, like, a lot of your really funny Sopranos impersonation tweets, or just you tweeting about how the show was, like, really fucking good. Like, both of those things combined was, like, was kind of like, oh yeah, I should actually catch up with that. And then I, like, watched it on the first two on, like, an airplane trip, and then I was like, oh yeah, we're all in on this.
I'm so glad. I mean, if I can make a few dozen people watch The Sopranos, I'll consider myself a success.
Yeah, no, it was truly something where I was like, okay, like, it's just also, yeah, it was wild to watch it and be like, oh wow, this is literally what every other TV show's been ripping off for, like, two decades now.
Yeah, it's nuts.
So much of it is just like, oh, okay. Like, I guess I get it. Like, you really did make a really good show that everyone else kind of took a little bit out of for a bunch of other TV.
Yeah.
And then, you know, just I think the other thing that I really connected with your work that I wanted to, like, just do an anecdote about the I Don't Want to Grow Up thing is, like, a year before that article was published, I was driving back home from a show with a friend of mine who is also like just a was like a writer guy and does like pop culture like I do and stuff, and we're getting to know each other a little better, and we're walking down to a bar, and I was trying to describe this frustration I was having with like basically why I'm such a big nerd, but I also hate talking to people about it. I don't like going out and like proselytizing, like I did that when I was a teen, and I always felt really like, you know, like kind of weird about it, and I'm like, I'm 31, so I always say like I'm in the last class of children that could have possibly gotten made fun of for liking Batman at a certain point.
Right.
So mainstream now that like I maybe it does happen, but that concept seems weird to me. Like, who could get mad at a kid for liking the Avengers of this day and age, whatever.
Right.
And it's like all that kind of stuff. And then I was saying to him, I was like, man, I love a lot of things. Fucking hate fans. And he was like, you nailed it. And I was like, yeah. And then a year later, your article came out, and I was like, she nailed it. I was like, because it just crystallized so much of what, like, I was kind of feeling about that level of just super weird entitlement and ownership that people start to have over what is literally, like, an intellectual property, right? It's a media.
Right.
Many, many people work on it. It's the sum of many parts. It's fun to watch sometimes, but it's, like, to treat it like, and a piece of art that one person is responsible for is nuts, and yet so many people do.
Yeah, it's bananas.
Yeah, it's and like, yeah, I've worked enough in like some of the entertainment industry. I've worked as like production assistants, just to know that it's so grindy and not clean and complicated that every time I would see these fan perspectives on things, it would drive me insane. I would just be like, I'd like try to read someone's opinion, and I'd just be like, not how it works. That's not how it works. Nope, nope, nope. Like,
right. It's like illiteracy.
Mindset. Yeah, yeah. It's illiteracy. Absolutely. So just that, I don't know, the fact that you're writing about that broke through to so many people, it was nice to see it, you know, it was like a buoy out in the ocean. I was like, oh crap, good, there's other people out there that are seeing this and that think this is that like I'm not taking crazy pills here, like it sucks. Like,
that's really the most I could ask for any of my work. I'm glad that it had something for you. I feel like right now, you know, creators have never been more accessible, and people have never had as low a barrier to shouting their opinions.
Yeah. And there's so many that like, it's like, cool, man, you shouted your opinion. That wasn't very different than other people's opinions. It takes a lot to cut through.
Right. It's a mess out there.
I was about to say, yeah, in terms of that, like the initial reaction was like, not all positive. And obviously I'm not going to focus on that, but I do think there's a tendency now for, I would say that one thing you do well, and I would say that article is like a harsh criticism, in that it's not like an infantilizing piece, but it's talking about the process of self-infantilization, right? In that a lot of people, Maybe they don't necessarily get to have the idealized childhood or this or that through a lot of mitigating factors beyond their control. But like, it's a harsh criticism. And I also feel we live in a time with a lot of destructive criticism where I'm not going to name the specific writer, but there's an Australian of some report where if she sees a trans person, she's going to like say they're a member of NAMBLA and that they're a pedophile or a child rapist or something.
Right.
She looks like the goddamn Crypt Keeper, but has all of these sort of remarks about others. Like, And it's very strange in as much as you would figure, because we live in a world with ugly people or people that are otherized or this or that. And like, okay, they're going to imagine she's otherized in some way. I try to empathize because hell, I am. But at the same time, it's just also like, I feel a lot of those sort of critiques are like destructive critiques. Like in terms of your output of work, like, is there a way to sort of have a consistent output of harsh critique while still having a level of empathy to the human experience? Like, is it a fine line we all have to sort of walk sometimes?
I think that it is. You know, I wish there was an easy way to explain how to do that. I think that, as in so many other situations, what you have to do is try your best and learn as you go. And inevitably, if you are going to venture opinions on big issues, you'll probably ruffle some feathers, get things wrong. I guess if I were to boil it down to one piece of advice, I would say never dig your heels in. There's just nothing to be gained by getting defensive when someone points out a mistake you made. And I'm not immune to that impulse at all. Who is?
It's
very natural. And it's good advice too.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most important things you can learn, especially as a writer or just a general citizen on the internet, is that sometimes you're wrong and it's not really a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
I said this the other day in class. I'm studying to be a therapist, so this is like, a lot of your work also speaks to me on that level of like, what are these people thinking these days? Everyone has to learn to hold that L. You have to.
Yep.
Can't get it. Like, there's I used to play competitive Magic the Gathering. All of my hobbies are specifically about games where I have to just pretend to kill other people. I play a lot of shooters and stuff. I try hard and lose a lot at these activities, and getting pissy about it never helped me get better at those games. Never, not once. And yeah, that just straight up applies to like most things in life.
Absolutely. Being a gracious and big-hearted loser is such an important skill. Mm-hmm. Because typically the things that you can compete at are not terribly important in the greater scheme, but the relationships you can form around them are, or at least can be, extremely important.
I fully credit getting my ass whooped in the Seattle Magic the Gathering scene with making me a more mature and understanding human being.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It's a whole, like, some of the most I've ever learned is from people who were like, they were way better at me. They also didn't care as much. Mm-hmm. And I was like, how's that work? And they're like, you know, you just gotta not get that mad about stuff and play your game. And I was like, oh my God, what a concept, right? Like, not going on tilt if I make a mistake? Who'd have thought that was possible? But it's like a very valuable, you know, life lesson. And it's something that I'm like bringing into like my schooling now, because I've had to explain to multiple people, like, listen, and this is where like what resonates with me about your work too, is like the central thesis of a lot of this is like, people just don't want to feel uncomfortable. And we have a culture that really sets it up so that in a lot of ways they don't have to, I guess, is like, that's not maybe the most accurate way of putting it, but
I mean,
they feel entitled to comfort more than they are willing to examine their uncomfort.
Yes. I don't think that they, that
blows my mind.
I don't think that they necessarily have comfort in many arenas.
Exactly.
And in fact, I think that plays into it. I think one of the most pronounced factors in people behaving so badly is that they don't have control over their own lives. And so when they come into like some sort of abstract scenario where you might actually be able to exert a lot of control, the urge to sort of project your problems onto an arena where they can be solved, it's very appealing.
Yeah, in many ways, it's also sort of like it can then in turn like a tendency, or I don't know, maybe a pathology, tomato, tomato, fucking. You can also just like gain a following off of that, like the specific pronounced ways in which a person can be stubborn,
right,
can then gain a cult of personality, and now you are outside the circle. No, you're making your own circle.
I was going to say, which is an aspect of this also becomes, well, I'm not the only one who's upset about this.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And here's a bunch of people that liked my tweet that said, I hate such and such creator for such and such reason.
Right, and
for such and such thing.
And like fascism. Like
now I feel like that matters because I'm getting those likes.
And stuff. That validation, yeah. And like fascism, it's emotionally and politically incoherent. None of it makes any sense. None of it appeals to anything that you could reproduce or demonstrate. But that doesn't matter because, again, at the center of it is the idea that whatever you're feeling is very important and has wider ramifications. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that almost everything we feel isn't and doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. It's a hard
one
to learn, but once you learn it, life gets easier, in my opinion. I don't know. Like, yeah.
Some people
experience, I get a lot less worried these days, but.
I mean, yeah, what's the tendency sometimes referred to as like sort of like a main character syndrome or whatever? Yes. Like basically.
Absolutely.
Like working off of that axis and then your personal or revulsion or this or that, where the ways in which you feel alienated, like if anything, mark the fact you're definitely a part of a greater whole, and not that you don't really have a lot of sort of weight or center that like is quantifiable, like mm-hmm. like all of it's ephemeral, but beyond that there's just how well you've convinced yourself you have power. You especially see this in like very small spheres of like leftism, et cetera. It's not yeah. really a knock of it, but it's like basically you sort of have all of this hemming and hawing about all of these specific discrete outcomes. But at the end of the day, it's like, okay, maybe X amount of podcasts, if you added them all up together, and then the followers have said podcasts, and then like the people paying into it, it's like maybe 400,000-ish people. And then there's, again, polling where it's like, well, you know, nearly half of all millennials, et cetera, like, are favorable to socialism. But that is just like a discrete opinion. It's not a fucking outcome. Those don't lead to votes. Right. Those don't lead to political outcomes. So it's just feeling, and you could feel however you'd like about something, but that feeling doesn't lead to a specific outcome without a specific discrete series of actions, which a lot of people have kind of confused. If we could talk about like discrete actual outcomes, fandom always leads to that shit because the consumer mindset is very, very punctuated and very very vocal. Yeah. I mean, in as much as your book, like, is that like in kind of the schema of like how you're going to sort of approach like press reaction or pushback or anything? Like, has anyone given you shit in as far as this book thus far?
Yeah, I've had a couple of waves of varyingly unpleasant pushback on Twitter, mostly. You know, the book is just starting to be semi-widely reviewed. Mm-hmm. And I imagine sooner or later it will come into the hands of someone who has some really strong emotions about it in a negative way. And but mostly so far what I've had pushback to are tweets.
Oh.
So, you know, like a two sentence synopsis of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And the big one has been that the virus in this fictional world only affects people with a certain amount of testosterone in their system. And various groups of people have gotten mad about this. Trans women who choose not to medically transition trans men who view it as sort of invalidating of their relationship with testosterone. And in as much as I have one, my strategy has been to first offer a calm explanation that this is not what this book is about, and that fictional things, you know, the novum around which fiction is built, they don't exist as a referendum on what I would like to happen in real life.
Oh, yeah. Oh boy.
Yeah, I have never written a book that I would like to live through or see happen.
Yeah. That's
everything.
It reminds me a bit of people acting like television shows need to acknowledge the pandemic. Like, that's that same mindset of like, you know, this isn't real, right? You know, you can just pretend it doesn't exist in this world, right? Like, that's what that reminded me of.
But I mean, it is interesting, yeah, that the, I mean, I would say kind of, because I've kind of ran into this myself, as I definitely wanted you to be a guest in my own personal work. Like, some of the pushback I did get was from like some amount of trans people or this or that, or just to, in all fairness, I got pushback from a weird discreet group of trans people who was like deeply red conservative. Like, it's a micro minority within a micro minority. Oh yes. Right. Oh, yeah. I read them too. Good fucking God. That's,
I can't even imagine.
But yeah, the idea that you could kind of make a monolithic universal experience kind of runs counter to like the idea of fiction. Like, you just be making nonfiction where you just decided, all right, let's unleash this virus that gets X amount of people with testosterone, and, you know, let's look at the outcome. No, but I mean, It's interesting, like the kind of, a lot of people would like to assume that they are sort of inoculated against that weird consumer dogpile impulse, especially if they're X person from a marginalized group. like, and no, you live in the same America I do. We maybe run the race slightly differently. Maybe you have X amount of mitigating factors. I sure know I do. But like, that's kind of why we need like specific views and outlooks. And like, not all of them are like weaponized against you specifically. I've seen so many trans women like straight up lose careers or like have their lives destroyed, or like they self-sabotaged because they straight up could not handle an onslaught of people that looked like them or shared the experience they had, being like fucking annihilated. And I mean, one of the interesting things about your output was like, that's kind of, you don't always like come at it straight, but it seems to be something you're conscious of in your work. And I mean, it to a larger part, besides discrete stuff like the, you know, transness, there's just also like filmic takes you have that like a lot of people do not have. Like, for example, how did you feel about Dune? Did you enjoy the film Dune?
It certainly wasn't my least favorite thing ever, but I didn't think much of it, and I really. I don't understand the appeal of Timothée Chalamet. He's completely devoid of charisma. He's just sort of a wet towel. I can understand that other people enjoy him for reasons that don't register in my brain, and that's fine. My job is to convey my own experience, not explain what experience other people should be having.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that the two biggest sticking points with the movie for me were that I found it to be a very conservative adaptation of a really nutty novel. just sort of timid, aesthetically unadventurous. And also, I hate that fucking fat suit that they put Stellan Skarsgård in. I hate it so fucking much. It made me insane with rage every time I saw it. It's so bad.
Yeah, I
haven't seen it. Is he playing the Baron Harkonnen? Or is that...
Yes, he is.
Okay. So I've only seen like stills. Like, oh man, I can only imagine.
And he's in like... He's in like a lot of latex, but not enough.
Yeah.
So it's just the worst of all possible worlds.
I was about to say, like, I almost... I don't... Is this like a CGI intensive movie? You almost would have figured that they would have CGI'd his ass.
Yeah, it's quite a CGI intensive movie, and I imagine there's some touch up going on there. Mostly, he just looks like a potato. He doesn't look like a fat person. He looks like a potato.
That's maybe what the Dune universe does to a person.
Yeah, I mean,
harsh,
you know,
the harsh potato sands. That's my fascinating thing with Dune is I've had pretty much no experience with the novel. My earliest memories of Dune were seeing commercials for the sci-fi television adaptation.
Oh, I grew up on those. I loved them.
But I never saw it, but that was like I saw commercials for it. And then I have had multiple people in my life who have all had extremely close relationships with Dune, but all have very different opinions about it. When this movie comes out, I could like scroll my timeline and see people who will all agree that Dune is a fantastic book, and they're all just like, this movie fucking sucked. I love this movie. This fulfilled a dream of mine. I can't believe this thing looked like garbage. I'm just like, who knows, man? Like, you all like Dune, so
you know, in
a movie. That's what I was like, I guess it was a movie.
In my opinion, that's great. You know, a movie that can support robust reactions like that. It's always something that
it at least means something's going on in there.
Right. And that movie is definitively the vision of Denis Villeneuve, who's not someone whose vision I particularly want to see, but it's him, and you couldn't mistake it for someone else.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of virtue in that on its own, especially in the modern film landscape, where most blockbusters are virtually indistinguishable.
Right. And I think that's like, man, being able to say that about a movie that you're not even that stoked about is just smart. Like, that's just like, yeah, of course. But it does take that level of self-awareness that a lot of people don't have. I'm just like,
yeah,
at least this is not a play by numbers thing, even if it's not my favorite thing.
Right.
Yeah. For those.
I had people, I'm a big Halloween fan. So I watched Halloween Kills. And in the moment I was like, I'm fucking in for this, whatever. This is the most fan service-y bullshit I've ever seen. But I'm like on it for the ride. But then immediately when I got done, some of my other Halloween loving friends were like, what a piece of garbage. And I was like, nah, I guess I could see that too. I was just like, I just had to take my own feelings for what they were. I was like, you know what? I fell for it in the moment. Maybe if I watch it again, I won't like it as much. But most Halloween movies are mashups of shit that happens in other Halloween movies. And that's what that movie was. So,
yeah, you know it's an interesting choice of words that you fell for it, because ultimately that's why we go to the movies.
Exactly. It's like, you know, I don't need to get out of the theater and be really breaking down the Halloween movie I just watched. And I love this franchise with all my heart. I just know that's not what it's for.
Right. You know, we're going there to see a fiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're going to that's the thing. I get so tired of people that just start what's that, like, that's just the type of criticism that is the most lazy in the world, which is like, yeah, it doesn't work like that in real life. No shit.
Oh my god.
No shit.
Who cares? If we wanted to see real life, I would fucking go outside.
Yeah, I would literally like turn on the news. Like,
I mean, yeah, there is a tendency in like, and it's not really criticism so much as it's like a sort of maladroit What if I did like a film review, but we just threw out the concept of suspension of disbelief, as if what is the fantastic really? Like a truck couldn't do a front flip like in the Batman Nolan movie.
I feel like someone just would have shot Liam Neeson and taken, you know, it would have happened.
Yeah.
There's no.
Yeah, that tendency, I think it's not 100% like a part of the problem, but I think it's also a lot of film review sites and also a lot of websites that started having to wear a lot of different hats, where we weren't just a video game site. Now we're a movie review site or whatever. Like right. IGN, for example, is a big outlet that quite literally does everything. I think some of the first few comic book reviews I had read were like IGN, because they would have like big write-ups and actually would show you the comic book canon of this or that or whatever, and like give you intro lists. I want to kind of go back a bit in as much as like, I think about that. And then like, probably when I was reading stuff like that, like, God, sometime later, I would say where you kind of came up through, aside from self-publishing, was like sites that maybe kind of did that or still do. I like where the outlet, the tent is a lot bigger. Pop culture criticism, where it's all of the above. Yeah. In terms of that, like, how did you feel like you had like established your voice? Because the barrier for entry in this current era, has never been lower, but also like the potential for making money, like cumulatively as a freelancer, has also never been lower, in as much as you're up against an army of people that would do all of this shit for free.
Right. Absolutely. Like
cutting your teeth and doing all of this, like coming up in criticism, what was your process for like sort of getting your output there and like being affirmed in ways that like didn't just move you forward, but like move the work generally forward? Like,
well, it was extremely grueling and difficult. And I only made the first step towards getting any kind of substantive compensation when I had the freedom to breathe a little and stop focusing on day-to-day survival. You know, for the first few years of my writing career, when I was doing stuff for token payment or no payment, which I strongly do not recommend to any new writers. I don't think you should do it for any number of reasons. Start a Tumblr or a blog and post your writing for yourself. It's going to be better in the long run. But when I first started those first few years, I was a copy editor. I was a professional dominatrix, and I was really, really struggling to make ends meet. I would steal to eat, and just in general, it was very difficult to make time and mental space to write anything. And I don't think it's an accident that things only took off after I left the shitty relationship that I was in and accepted that I was like failing to make a living for myself. And I was lucky enough to be able to move back in with my parents for a couple of months. And once I had that support, I was able to pitch, and I was lucky enough to have made some friends in television and film criticism and in independent comics. Sean Collins and Matt Zollerseitz and Julia Graffaire were all early proponents of my work, and helped me get my first gig, which I think was writing about Succession, a show I don't care for, at Polygon.
Oh God, holy shit. Thank you. You're like making a lot of great points that I think everyone should take to heart. Like, We could talk at length at a different time. You and I have a lot of, let's say, experiential overlap. That said, yeah, no, Succession, probably one of the worst fucking things Adam McKay has ever done. I want to cut my head off and throw it at a fucking wall when I hear everyone raving about it. It's,
okay, but isn't it's, the thing that you didn't watch it? Gretchen had to watch it.
Oh no, I did watch it. Stopped watching it because I was just like, I can just watch The Big Short.
About what it is. It's a
I can watch The Big Short and fucking Huff Poppers, and it still sucks.
With the
same cast too. That no Steve Carell. That's the only thing you're missing. But sorry, as an aside.
No, the thing I will actually bring up here, just as
motherfucker.
No. you also by saying that I have not gotten to Billions yet, but you are the reason it is on my list of things to watch.
Billions rules.
Yeah. Because I saw you.
Billions. It's not Succession.
Like, well, if she likes that more than Succession, then I should give it a shot. So I do need to give that a shot.
It's fun. I would not put it in like.
Right. Exactly.
In competition with the greatest shows ever made, but it's like really fun pulp.
That's all I'm about. Mm. Yeah, that's some good TV right there.
But yes, I'm sorry. Succession, as you were saying, you were writing about Succession, and that's. Right. That's where there's like a tipping point. Yes.
Yeah. That's after that, I got hired by Merritt Kay to write for the VRV blog, which was this sort of short-lived experiment that grew off of Crunchyroll, of all things. Right.
It was attached to a streaming service?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. I remember this.
And that's where I posted a lot of my initial articles that got traction and started to build a readership for me. And once that, once some executive at Crunchyroll looked at a column and said, what the fuck are we paying out for this for? And the site got shut down. I hopped with Merritt over to Fanbyte. And I would say that most of my published work is there because Merritt and I have a good relationship. But, I do sort of wider, more general stuff. I worked with The Outline a couple of times. RIP.
Yeah.
I've worked with Gawker a few times, Nylon Magazine. And really it all stemmed from that first break. Once you get it, it becomes so much easier to do it again. Most editors, if they can find a sure thing, would love to keep it.
Absolutely. Yeah. How did, just as an aside, just kind of with that in mind, I mean, you mentioned The Outline. Like, personally, my frustration with a lot of stuff is also like a lot of outlets also just fucking die outright. And like, your relationship with those past editors or whatever are still having their contact information sometimes for a lot of newer writers is sort of essential, especially if like that site is down. I mean, once you become more established, as you said, like did it feel less as though you were kind of hopping from platform to platform that's literally disappearing behind you?
Yes, absolutely. When I first started freelance writing for film criticism and cultural crit, I was dealing with a lot of anxiety from financial insecurity. I was not super functional on a day-to-day basis. This is such a frustrating thing to talk about because really what most people need is enough money to relax. Like they need that more than they need medication. They need it more than they need therapy. And ultimately it was the thing that allowed me to start repairing my mental health. Was just having a little bit of money and knowing that I would continue to have a little bit of money next month. And if I had another piece of advice to give prospective writers, it would be have a Patreon, make your own work for yourself. no matter how small that base is, it's better to own your own stuff.
Oh yeah. In terms of that, owning our intellectual property, our comic, like, is it hasn't all been a bed of roses, obviously, but like, I'm still, that is still my thing I can retain. And like, if we want to like work out merch or adaptations, blah, 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 et cetera, or whatever, that's our intellectual property. We can do that, as opposed to, I think now a tendency is for people to kind of get the very obvious paycheck. Obviously, in comics, a lot of people don't like hearing this shit, but if you're the writer in comics, you got the easier fucking job, without question.
Absolutely. No question.
but like, people are going to snatch you up and put you on all of these properties. And a lot of people throw a lot of their very interesting ideas at, like, say, a Marvel or a DC. And you know what? They can just sort of use that as R&D for whatever they're going to put into a movie that you're never going to see your fucking residuals for. You're Absolutely. Never going to see that money. Maybe you get a credit. Maybe a bunch of people in a fan site say, well, this was from that arc that this person did. You're never going to see that fucking money. It's like, give them your dog shit ideas if you're going to take the paycheck. Like, yeah. Like bottom feeding, lowest common denominator shit. Like, because the tendency is for people that, like, if I have enough time in, I'm going to maybe get that deal that Brian Michael Bendis did where he gets health care.
Right.
He's the one fucking guy who can do that. The one guy. Okay, he's the one guy who can ask for health care and dental. Do you have any idea how fucking insane that is?
A lot of these superhero comics that are like the ones that we're talking about that kind of broke through or that led to the Brian Michael Bendis stuff, like, that all happened pre-MCU, pre-Disney buying Marvel. And most of the stuff that's happened since in the comics fucking sucks. It's not, like, gonna make that type of a mark. We're not gonna get another Winter Soldier type thing where, you know, some indie comics writer breaks in and, like, brings a it just feels like that doesn't happen anymore. And, like, everything that comes out is, I'm hoping that part of the reason for that is that a lot of the talent out there knows to not necessarily make their house in these companies. Because you see these bigger names like Brian Bendis, all these people, they're moving out. Like, they have some mainstream work, but they're very certain to, like, get their indie shit printed all the time and keep it in circulation and all that type of stuff.
Well, I think that part of it is also that kind of success and auteurship is antithetical to what Disney wants out of a film.
Absolutely.
They would like you to see the film as something that sprang into existence because the Disney brand summoned it. And if there's, you know, there's stars who are sort of action figures, mm-hmm. and then there's a director who exists to kind of give the movie a flavor. Mm-hmm. And that's about it.
Someone pointed out the other day.
All of these movies, sorry to interrupt, but all of these movies, basically, if you're making an MCU movie, Chloe Zhao is, like, currently one of the few that is, like, going to be filmed on location, but these are all made in pre-viz, which is sort of like, for the uninitiated, a lot of movies were storyboarded, or you'd see, like, sort of comic outlines of what you'd be shooting for a scene, as opposed to pre-visualization, which is like a sort of computerized animation that, like, shows bop, 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 A, B, C.
Previs is a CGI animatic for a movie.
Basically.
Yeah. Many, many Marvel movies are now shot in good old my hometown of Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia, where big companies from London came in and built a huge studio lot outside of Atlanta. And ever since that time, every Marvel movie has been shot on a few locations in Atlanta that are made to look like a few other spots, and in front of and in large, like, studio rooms that are blue screens, and with a lot of other, you know, bad effects put on top of them. And someone pointed out, like, because of the way the timing of all this worked out and, like, kind of how Marvel went from, like, 4 Paramount-produced films to being acquired by Disney and turned into, like, a whole fucking machine after all the success, was that, like, this was always inevitable, but, like, I just remember when Edgar Wright kicked out of Ant-Man, and I was like, that fucking sucks. It seems like you would be such a no-brainer to have, like, a great director like him make a fucking Ant-Man movie. And that was, like, the biggest writing on the wall you could ever see for, like, the future of what Marvel movies would become. Like, when this very notably, like, director that nobody dislikes in Hollywood is, like, having trouble with Marvel to make the movie he wants. And decides to walk away and says, hey, you know what? Nah, that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, that around that period in their history as a studio, they were going through a string of director disagreements and people walking away from projects. The other one that pops to mind is Ron Howard walking off of Star Wars Rogue One, or maybe it was Solo. Anyway,
no, he had to fix Solo, wasn't it? Because the
he had to. I think Jesus, I'm all tangled up here. I'm gonna
talk right about though. I know Solo was like two different sets of people, basically.
Yeah, and so was Rogue One. Another director came in and storyboarded and rewrote the entire ending.
Right. So these movies aren't even like, yeah, we're in here in this age where it's like the panel of people that are in charge with the intellectual property have more input than the creative, supposedly creative people tasked with literally making the movie.
Well, Jake, depending on your view of history, one could say the by the committee form of filmmaking is not necessarily a new form in Hollywood, but maybe that Hollywood, or maybe just American film generally, because as you said, George is like fucking neo-Hollywood, it's like cyclical. It was this way with Westerns specifically. Specific types of genre filmmaking. Like, I kind of feel like superhero films are a kind of big reactionary cycle we're in.
They were so much less. Like, the biggest difference to me is that superhero films are as big as they are because they're inherently tied to this, like, merchandising infrastructure that, like, most other movies do not give you. Outside of kids' movies. And the whole reason superhero movies are great is because they're kids' movies for adults who can go out and buy shit about them. Like, it's sad to say it like that, but it's just like, yes, like, you go to Target, you see the number of things you can buy that are MCU themed, and you think, I'm thinking, like, oh, this used to only be in the toy aisle. And now it's, like, everywhere. It's just the only thing that we did kids, kind of, as a maybe not so great practice in the first place.
I kind of wanted to ask Gretchen about this, though. Like, in terms of filmic reactionary cycles, action movies of a certain Reagan era were like all right wing, like, let's gun down every brown person in sight. Okay. The torture porn cycle in film, sort of as a reaction to Afghanistan and Iraq in progress.
Right.
And then the Obama era is quite literally 2008. They start Iron Man onward, and we have 20 years onward of just one type of fucking movie that is the sole multi-billion dollar. Well, okay, fair enough.
What I mean, like, it's just like, it's like pick your poison.
It's simply the size of Disney's film monopoly that is exceptional.
Well, that's like, again, this goes back to me being a literal, like, early nerd. $4 billion they paid for Marvel. Like, I mean, how much has that gotten them back at this point? That's an insane on their investment. But I remember sitting in the high school computer lab reading on comicbookresources.com that Disney had just bought Marvel for $4 billion. And I was like, what the fuck is happening right now?
Yeah, that was bananas at the time.
Yeah, it was absolutely nuts at the time.
But I wanted to ask you, because I kind of, to circle back to that sort of article sort of about self-infantilization or what have you. Like, I don't want to like bang on this drum that many others have, but like there's this sort of tendency within like MCU fandom specifically, because of where it started and the fact that it's never ended. I mean, right now in the COVID era is the most it's ever slowed down. And with Shang-Chi, it looks like it may start back up again, but like,
it already has, yeah.
But to that end, like, do you see any sort of over, like is the MCU sort of like gender queer shit for straight people? What, like, what is it like? Like,
no, I think it's just slop, and a lot of people for a lot of different reasons like to eat slop. You know what you're getting.
It's the same as the Big Bang Theory being inexplicably the most popular TV show.
Right, or NCIS.
Right, yeah, yeah.
The to bring it back to The Sopranos, I think it's season 4 or maybe 5 that opens with Agent Dwight Harris leaning out of his car to puke on the side of the road and then saying, "Nobody ever went broke underestimating the taste of the American public."
Yeah.
You know,
I mean,
genuinely, people don't have taste, and that's not a moral judgment.
Right.
Taste is something you have to build, and it'll only ever be a comparatively small number of people who have like a refined palate for film. Not to say that lots of people can't appreciate complex or sort of offbeat or challenging movies, but that recognizing and being able to articulate what makes a film good or bad is a fairly rare skill. Mm-hmm. And I think that fundamentally most people go to the movies because they want to be comforted or turn their brains off or get excited. You know, they do it and it's the same to them as getting on a roller coaster. Nobody analyzes roller coasters.
I mean, but there is a sort of flattening effect with this specific type of spectacle. Wouldn't you agree that, like, if everything is this over, if every bit of output kind of has a sort of tinge of the superheroic and sort of the way in which it's mainly CGI, and like very few stunt actors or very few practical effects or things we've come to recognize as like film, and otherwise we would say, well, this is an animated film, right? So those lines blur so specifically in that type of film. Like, would you say there's like maybe some sort of flattening effect where if that's like this the sort of normalized image, then like is there any way to sort of be transgressive or like challenge your audience in that framework? I mean, like,
within that framework, no, Disney will never do anything meaningful. Yeah. Never again, I don't think. And nor will anyone working in that mold. I think the absolute best you can do with it is what the DC movies occasionally do, which is dumb fun.
Absolutely.
Which is really,
and they put much more, like, the thing that I was thinking with regards to what you said, Michelle, is that we live in this era where to make something supposedly fantastic on a movie screen is more a matter of computer processing and technical artists than it is of practical effects. Like, one of the most transgressive things I could think of for any filmmaker would be to go back to doing like maybe even just like CGI, like painted over or like supported, like very effective practical stuff. Because what bums me out about the Marvel movies is you can watch some of the early ones and see way more like on location stuff or excitingly framed action spots, and like some of the early CGI is just kind of whatever. But then once they built that studio in Georgia, and once like we kind of enter in that era that we were talking about where director disagreements begin and the formula starts to get formula, like everything has that terrible blue screen effect to it and that terrible post-processing effect to it. And I think that's just so It's just the fact that we have this quote unquote easy way out. Not that any of the work those people do is easy.
No, but it is it is non-union, so it's much easier to exploit.
Absolutely, another very relevant part of this picture for sure is that, like, yeah, what are we going to do? Get a bunch of fantastic and wonderful sets built, or pay people on computers to make it happen?
To speak to the rest of what you were saying, Michelle, yeah, I think this is a really destructive impulse or influence on the world of film. I think that it does flatten people's understanding of and relationship to film as a medium. And while I love and appreciate and will continue to seek out the less mainstream or outright independent film that continues to come out even in the shadow of this monopoly, you know, there's no shortage of good movies to watch. It's just that there are fewer resources to go around. So not as many of them get made as have been made at other points in film history. I think I lost my thread.
No, we're good. There's something to be said for, I think that tendency is really, really strange, because you make the choice for other types of film and other types of, like, narrative form, like television, etc. The weirdest tendency I've seen, maybe I said tender queer in the pejorative or whatever, but what I mean, the air quotes tender queer, not to paint with a broad brush because I fucking hate it, but there is a group of people that, like, have this, I hate fascism, I hate this or that, but, like, are completely antagonistic to people fucking in things. And having sex and stuff is completely normal as hell. I cannot tell you how insane I felt when I thought of this, when I asked someone, so I wasn't going insane, but there hasn't been a sex scene in Marvel films. And then recently they put it out on like a discussing film or this or that placard for the website. And they're like, Chloe Zhao says this will not feature one, but two sex scenes. It's like, holy shit. People can fuck in these movies now. Like, that's legal.
Ever fucked.
I doubt.
They don't even kiss. Don't even fucking kiss. Yeah, maybe Cap and Sharon Carter kissed at the end of, like, Endgame. But like a holocaust of the half of the universe had to happen for him to go back in time and kiss someone in the 1950s. That is the scale you have to work at in fucking Marvel to kiss someone, to maybe do heavy petting. It's fucking insane.
Nobody's getting laid in the MCU.
Yeah, no, it's bananas, and I do think that people have been taught to regard sexuality as frightening and alien. Even their own sexuality, which is, it's interesting that became sort of decoupled from religion, because you'll see it reproduced uncritically in secular culture. And this is nothing new, you know, WASPs aren't necessarily really Christian. But they are for sure ashamed of their bodies and urges. But seeing it propagate to online spaces and into mainstream criticism even, I mean, it's so common for people who have professional positions to talk about how there's no reason to show rape in any media, or there's no need to have a sex scene in any movie. And it's like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Like, saying you can't show people eating or having a conversation. Like, this is a way that human beings relate to each other.
It's the gore shit. It just makes me think of Tipper Gore and the whole campaign of parental advisory. It's just the same shit.
Yeah, it's absolutely an outgrowth of that. Yeah. It's fucking Phyllis Schlafly all over again.
Yeah.
I mean, and there's also sort of a tendency where, like, I think a lot of people, I almost sort of hesitate to to sort of cast it in these terms, but it's also just like, well, you could maybe have a dissenting opinion about this specific subject, like if you were sexually assaulted. As someone who has been sexually assaulted, I can only think of violent, awful things towards that rhetorical framing device. It's so absolutely fucking stupid and reductive.
It is. It's permeated the creation of fiction and discussion around that at virtually every level. And no matter how well-intentioned, you know, with stuff like the own voices idea, where people are telling their own stories and not getting exploited by white guys who are coming in and taking their cultural heritage or their experience of various cultural forms of oppression and making something that then makes money for the white guy. You know, that's a well-intentioned idea, but what it turned into is policing everyone for writing anything that isn't a direct reflection of their daily life. And that's insane.
It quite literally is. There's no one universal experience, and we're now sort of in a cultural criticism moment, especially now where we can recognize that people's output can have real world effects, but is it anecdotal? Is it part of a larger overarching societal project? Maybe just even beyond entertainment, like the BBC now. The BBC, I'm going to say the most charitable things towards the BBC. And keep in mind, there's always a two-week sort of crawl between these episodes. But basically, the BBC has kind of gotten behind the position that, like, they would like to create a world in which trans women's heads are smashed against the ground with cinder blocks. That is their view of the world right now. And they work in kind with people and specific discrete bigot groups that are not just funded within the UK, but also America via the ADF and various American think tanks and groups of televangelists and evangelists generally. They usually throw like Heritage Foundation. They usually like throw $6 billion at that country and Europe generally. Hungary, the same. Poland is kind of pulling back because the EU is pushing back. We are going to see a decline as a reactionary backlash towards the normalization of some level of humanizing LGBT people through America doing marriage equality, but not only that, various discrete laws being passed in said countries, like in the air quotes general West, like because a lot of these countries have a lot of problems, and so you don't externalize, you go inward and you find this group to blame for cultural degeneration, etc. Like works in entertainment and media are going to reflect that, and people are having a lot of difficulty saying, is this a symptom or is this a direct output? Like Netflix itself, 13 Reasons Why, they start adding like a shit ton of warnings and prefaces beforehand, like maybe we are inducing suicide. Remember to always talk to someone in a medical capacity about suicide. And now Netflix is having issues with Dave Chappelle in his special The Closer, which if you've watched any of the Netflix specials, as I have, as much as people bitch about Nanette, all Chappelle has been fucking doing on Netflix has been Nanette. It's been Nanette parts 1 through 6. It is weird. It is didadactic. And Chappelle actually in his past had kind of done didactic stuff, but it didn't feel like a TED talk. It was like, hey, I'm being emotionally vulnerable with you about this deeply uncomfortable thing. We're going to have fun together. And this was like, I want you to learn about this fucking group of freaks. So now we're in this cultural moment where we have real world effects on people out there in the world. But we don't, but we do, but we don't, but we do. And like where as a critic and a cultural critic and someone who goes through all of this pop culture morass, like where do the lines begin and end? I know that's like another crazy big picture question, but like as you see it, like does it start and begin with power? Does it start with like power dynamics, exchanges of money? Like if you had to nail down where it starts, where would you say it starts? If it does,
I would say that it starts with anxiety of one form or another. And as I was talking about earlier, disgust is one form that anxiety can take.
Mm-hmm.
But more generally, imagine a person living in England who is born in 1970 and lives through first the recession and then economic boom and then recession again, and then no real recovery. Things just sort of start to creep downward in different ways. The infrastructure of the world has sort of fundamentally shifted. Money has been funneled upward. The middle class is evaporating. And suddenly the life that you were told that you'd have no longer exists. It's gone. And you have this angst, you have this anxiety, this fear of the future. And that's not something you can do anything about. You cannot topple the future by putting your shoulder against it. You cannot change a government by walking out into the street and yelling at the nearest cop that you disapprove heavily of the government's actions. It takes organized militant action to make that kind of change. But what you can do is blame someone weaker for the problem and then crush them.
I mean, yeah, that's the thing. I think the interesting thing about art, though, is like the impulse to crush, and the impulse to just be a stenographer. Like a lot of people don't really feel many other impulses besides those.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they do, but that's where it gets a lot more gray. Because yeah, there's the path of least resistance, or maybe you're David Chase and you see your whole life has been kind of marked specifically by your mother being really fucking shitty to you, and so you decide to remark on it, like remarking on decline, but like that maybe improves your station, and like you do that and you have that output, but like at the same time it's kind of like one of the shittier parts of creation is that it's going to stay self-contained. It's going to stay there. Like a lot of people are not moved to change by impassioned speeches, by seeing heroic actions, the people taking heroic actions and acting without thought towards their own life, they get ran over by the world. They don't make it out alive. It's the strangest part. Like I absolutely get the impulse of a lot of people that measure their victories by who they fucking can exert their level of power over, but like we sort of need a sort of identification of that gray morass where you've just become the thing you hate, and it's like no, no one became anything. We fucking are what we hate. There's a lot you and the Tory person have in common, and your differences might actually just be affectations. which a lot of people don't want to reconcile. And I want to believe there's a way forward on that, but like a lot of days it's very difficult to see. In as much as that, do you feel like literacy in X amount of subjects can be like a balm? It could be ameliorative towards this.
Yes, I think it can. But I think, at least in my own experience, it tends to operate on a smaller scale. The things that I see as successes in my life are forming friendships with people or helping people feel less alone with my work. I don't think that anyone, any but a tiny, tiny minority will really have their minds changed by a book or a movie or listening to a speaker. Mostly what I think art gives you is the perspective or insight or courage to act on impulses you already have or to not act on them. I think that the way forward for us is first, and I know nothing about this. I'm a complete rube in this arena, but I think it's armed insurrection.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the second part is the nurturing of community. And I don't just mean broad groups of people who share the same descriptors. I mean feeding each other and loving each other and touching each other and making life bearable.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's really anything else.
Yeah. Oh no, absolutely.
It's extremely easy to overcomplicate the matter, in fact, and I think
yes,
it's good to keep those simple-minded bullet points like on a piece of paper in your head or something.
Very well said. Just as a postscript, when Gretchen Felker Martin said armed insurrection, this was of course in the video game Minecraft, via Redstone. But yes. I mean, yeah, no. The
mods for the video game Roblox.
I've never played Roblox, Jake.
Roblox is fucking terrifying. It's capitalism for children.
You
gathering just fucked up. Kids are literally able to program Roblox games for
them. We did the Fortnite episode.
I'd have to do a Roblox episode in the future.
No, fuck you. Fuck you. No.
It's going to get...
Yeah, no. We would do VR chat before we would do Roblox.
No, we wouldn't. Well, maybe. I don't know. That's another discussion. Shit.
Oh man, you gotta see this VR chat stuff. Silly.
Yeah,
I've never smoked crack cocaine, but you know, I'm just gonna dive into the deep end of that pool and say, you know, VR chat, it's like smoking crack cocaine. All right.
It's wild shit on VR chat. That's for sure.
On that note, as we said on the Ramones podcast, the only way forward is the death of liberal democracy. On that note, what's up, Jake?
Oh no, I said that's what's up.
That's what's up.
Because I was agreeing with you.
Yeah. On that note, Jake, I want to thank my producer, Jake. We will be coming back full steam with the full cast of characters in the near future.
I'm going to cut in before you wrap. I got one more question. Well, actually,
ooh, one question, absolutely.
One request. My question, have you seen that Chucky show yet?
I have not.
Pretty oh, good. It's, yeah, we've yeah, no.
It. We've been liking it.
We're liking it, folks.
I do love Don Mancini, and I love Brad Dourif and Jennifer Tilly, so I will be watching it.
It is slapping. So I definitely wanted to either ask if you liked it or recommend it if you had not seen it yet. And then
gay icon Don Mancini.
Yeah. The gay icon Chucky too, as far as I'm
concerned. Gay icon Chucky. He beats the gay kid. He's a monster.
That kid needed a little talking to. I don't want to spoil it.
I'm gonna spoil. He came to get a fucking black eye. I don't even,
I'm a genderqueer kid, Michelle. You know? I don't know what else to say.
Is it just like you're jumped in at a gang? Listen, I've got to listen. You may think this is weird, me kicking you in the face with my little doll boot. However, I will remind you, I have a gender queer child. No, gender fluid.
Yeah,
gender fluid.
Put the accent on gender fluid.
Gender fluid.
And then also, just in the interest of you being a cool shit liker, is there anything that you've been liking a lot lately that you maybe haven't had as much time to tweet about or get out into the world?
What's the new hotness
stuff on your plate, so to speak?
Oh man, I don't know about the new hotness because I am so tired and overworked right now, but I do have some hotness from the last few years spread out. One, everyone should watch Hagazusa, which is a witchcraft movie from 2016 directed by Lucas Fagelfeld. It's a German independent film about a woman who is accused of witchcraft by her small alpine community. And that's the whole plot. It's fucking incredible. It's all practical effects and extremely, extremely upsetting and violent and real. It's one of the few movies that I think really gets medieval mindset, which is always appealing to me because I find that period in human morality to be very interesting. I also recently read and loved B.R. Yeager's Negative Space, which is one of the most upsetting and frightening books that I've ever read in my life. It's sort of like, do you guys remember Salvia?
Like,
the drug?
Have I done it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, oh, yeah.
It's about a fictional version of Salvia that transports you to this sort of horrible other world of sorcery. And it's about
twice, and that was more than enough.
Yeah, yeah. For sure. Yeah. And
cool.
It's about teens who get their hands on that and touch off this gargantuan horrible suicide epidemic. Sheesh. It's really fucking incredible.
Actually,
it's also really gay.
Hell yeah.
In terms of other stuff, Julia Graffaire's comics, especially Vision and Laid Waste, I can't emphasize enough how much that work has been a touchstone for me through my career. Just like a commitment to being horny through misery.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Julia's is my favorite living horror artist.
Hell yeah. I've read a few of her shorter stories, but I really do need to crack into the more recent publications that came out through Fantagraphics, right?
Yeah, shit'll change your life.
Yeah, those are nuts. Those are very cool.
Hell yes.
Sweet.
All right. As always, I'm Michelle Perez. I'm joined with my producer, but mainly buddy, Jake. We'd like to again thank Gretchen Felker-Martin for joining us. Gretchen, where can readers, watchers, listeners, people of orifices reach you?
So my Twitter is @scumbelievable, which is like unbelievable, but with scum. And my Patreon is just my name, Gretchen Felker-Martin. That's where you'll find the broadest selection of my work. There's critical writing, there's horror fiction, and I also host a screening series for people who are looking to get an education in horror film, and it's offshoots. And you can also read my work at Fanbyte and various other publications.
All right, and in terms of...
When's that Manhunt coming out?
Yeah, when's that Manhunt coming out?
Manhunt comes out from Tor Nightfire February 22nd, 2022.
Sick.
Pre-order it on all of the sites that sell books. IndieBound elbowing that one a little bit more than the more mainstream ones. IndieBound pretty much can do what everybody else has done. I am not endorsing them. I'm just saying, if you don't want, like, If you don't want shit like what she puts out censored into a fucking fuck to death pile of rubble, don't just buy shit from Amazon.
Yeah.
good way to put it.
That said, we appreciate you coming on, Gretchen, and we thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me. This was a blast.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for chatting. I'm going to hit stop on the recording.